became almost too dark to see anything. For the next hour, the Saker slammed shot into the Spanish warship, and in the gloom, they saw white sails unfurl.
"He's going to run for it!"
Anders shouted hoarsely. There were cheers from the gun crew. More volleys were fired as the warship backed and filled, easing away from the mooring. Hunter's men kept up a steady pattern of shots, and even when the warship was no longer visible in the darkness, he gave orders to carry on firing. The crack of the Saker continued through the night. By the first light of dawn, they strained to see the fruits of their labors. The warship was again anchored, perhaps a quarter mile farther offshore, but the sun rose behind the vessel, making her a black silhouette. They could see no evidence of damage. They knew they had caused some, but it was impossible to judge the extent. Even in the first moments of light, Hunter was depressed. He could tell from the way the ship rode at anchor that she had not been seriously injured. With great good fortune, she had maneuvered the night waters outside the bay without striking coral or running aground. One of her topsail spars hung cracked and dangling. Some of her rigging was ragged, and her bow line was chipped and splintered. But these were minor details. Bosquet's warship was safe, riding smoothly in the sunlit waters offshore. Hunter felt enormous fatigue and enormous depression. He watched the ship some moments longer, noticing her motion. "God's blood," he said softly. Enders by his side had noticed it too. "Longish chop," he said. "The wind is fair," Hunter said. "Aye, for another day or so." Hunter stared at the long, slow sea swell that rocked the Spanish warship back and forth at anchor. He swore. "Where is it from?" "I'd guess," Enders said, "that it's straight up from the south this time of year." In the late summer months, they all knew to expect hurricanes. And as consummate sailors, they were able to predict the arrival of these frightful storms as much as 2 days in advance. The early warnings were always found in the ocean's surface. The waves, pressed forward by storm winds of 100 miles an hour, were altered in places far distant. Hunter looked at the still, cloudless sky. "How much time do you reckon?" Anders shook his head. "It will be tomorrow night, at the latest." "Damn," Hunter said. He turned and looked at the galleon in Monkey Bay. She rode easily at anchor. The tide was in, and it was abnormally high. "Damn," he said again, and returned to his ship. He was in a foul mood, pacing the decks of his ship under the hot midday sun, pacing like a man trapped in a dungeon cell. He was not inclined to polite conversation, and it was unfortunate that Lady Sarah Almont chose this moment to speak with him. She requested a longboat and crew to take her ashore. "To what end?" he said curtly. In the back of his mind, he wondered that she had made no mention of the fact that he had not visited her cabin the night previous. "What end? Why, to gather fruits and vegetables for my diet. You have nothing adequate on board." "Your request is quite impossible," he said, and turned away from her. "Captain," she said, stamping her foot, "I shall have you know that this is no mean matter to me. I am a vegetarian and eat no meat." He turned back. "Madam," he said, "I care not a whit for your eccentric fancies, and neither have the time nor the patience to oblige them."
"Eccentric fancies," she said, coloring. "I shall have you know that the greatest minds of history were vegetarian, from Ptolemy to Leonardo da Vinci, and I shall have you know further, sir, that you are a common drip-knuckle and a boor."
Hunter exploded in an anger matching hers. "Madam," he said, pointing to the ocean, "are you aware in your monumental ignorance that the sea has changed?" She was silent, perplexed, unable to connect the slight chop offshore to Hunter's obvious concern over it.
"It seems trivial enough for so large a ship as yours."
"It is, for the moment."
"And the sky is clear."
"For the moment."
"I am no sailor, Captain," she said.
"Madam," Hunter said, "the swells are running long and deep. They can mean only one thing. In less than 2 days' time, we shall be in the midst of a hurricane. Can you understand that?
A hurricane is a fierce storm, she said, as if reciting a lesson.
A fierce storm, he said. If we are still in this damnable harbor when the hurricane strikes, we shall be smashed to nothing. Can you understand that?
Very angry, he looked at her and saw the truth, that she did not understand. Her face was innocent. She had never witnessed a hurricane, and so she could only imagine that it was somehow greater than other storms at sea. Hunter knew that a hurricane bore the same relation to a fierce storm that a wild wolf bore to a lapdog. Before she could reply to his outburst, he turned away, leaning on a past pin. He knew he was being too harsh. His own concerns were rightly not hers, and he had every reason to indulge her. She had been up all night treating the burned seaman, an act of great eccentricity for a well-born woman. He turned back to face her. "Forgive me," he said quietly. "Inquire of Enders, and he will make arrangements for you to go ashore, so that you can carry on the noble tradition of Ptolemy and Da Vinci." He stopped.
"Captain?"
He stared into space.
"Captain, are you well?"
Abruptly, he walked away from her. "Don Diego!" he shouted. "Find me Don Diego!"
Don Diego arrived in Hunter's cabin to discover the captain drawing furiously on slips of paper. His desk was littered with sketches.
"I do not know if this will succeed," Hunter said. "I have only heard of it. The Florentine, Da Vinci, proposed it, but he was not heeded."
"Soldiers do not attend an artist," Don Diego said.
Hunter glowered at him. "Wisely or not," he said. Don Diego looked at the diagrams. Each showed a ship's hull, drawn in profile from above, with lines running out from the sides of the hull. Hunter drew another.
"The idea is simple," he said. "On an ordinary ship, each cannon has its own gun captain, who is responsible for the firing of that single gun."
"Yes?"
"After the gun is loaded and run out, the gun captain crouches behind the barrel and sights the target. He orders his men with hand spikes and side tackles to aim the gun as he thinks best. Then he orders his men to slide the wedge to set the elevation, again as his eye thinks best. Then he fires. This is the procedure for each individual gun."
"Yes,"
the Jew said. Don Diego had never actually seen a large cannon fired, but he was familiar with the general method of operation. Each gun was separately aimed, and a good gun captain, a man who could accurately judge the right angle and elevation of his cannon, was highly regarded, and rare. "Now then," Hunter said, "the usual method is parallel fire." He drew parallel lines out from the sides of the ship on the paper. "Each gun fires, and each captain prays that his shot will find its mark. But in truth, many guns will miss until the two ships are so close that almost any angle or elevation will hit the target. Let us say when the ships are within 500 yards. Yes?" Don Diego nodded slowly.
"Now the Florentine made this proposal," Hunter said, sketching a new ship. "He said, do not trust the gun captains to aim each volley. Instead, aim all the guns in advance of the battle. Look now what you achieve."
He drew from the hull converging lines of fire, which came together at a single point in the water.
"You see? You concentrate the fire at one place. All your balls strike the target at the same point, causing great destruction."
"Yes," Don Diego said, "or all your balls miss the target and fall into the sea at the same point. Or all your balls strike the bowsprit or some other unimportant portion of the ship. I confess I do not see the value of your plan."
"The value," Hunter said, tapping the diagram, "lies in the way these guns are fired. Think, if they are pre-aimed, I can fire a volley with only one man to a gun, perhaps even one man for two guns. And if my target is within range, I know I will score a hit with each gun." The Jew, aware of Hunter's short crew, clapped his hands together.
"Of course," he said.
Then he frowned.
"But what happens after the first volley?"
"The guns will run back from the recoil. I then collect all the men into a single gun crew, which moves from gun to gun, loading each and running it out again to the predetermined marks. This can be done relatively quickly. If the men are trained, I could fire a second volley within 10 minutes.
By then, the other ship will have changed position.
Yes, Hunter said. It will be closer, inside my point. So the fire will be more spread, but still tight. You see?
And after the second volley?
Hunter sighed. I doubt that we will have more than 2 chances. If I have not sunk or disabled the warship in those 2 volleys, we shall surely lose the day.
Well, the Jew said finally, it is better than nothing.
His tone was not optimistic. In a sea battle, warring ships usually settled a contest with 50 broadsides or more. 2 well-matched ships with disciplined crews might fight the better part of a day, exchanging more than 100 broadsides. 2 volleys seemed trivial.
It is, Hunter said, unless we can strike the aft castle or the magazine and shot hold.
Those were the only truly vulnerable points on a warship. The aft castle carried all the ship's officers, the helmsman, and the rudder. A solid hit there would leave the ship without guidance. The shot hold and magazine in the bow would explode the warship in a moment. Neither point was easily hit. To aim far forward or aft increased the likelihood of a harmless miss by all cannon.
The problem is our aim, the Jew said. You will set your marks by gunnery practice, here in the harbor.
Hunter nodded.
But how will you aim once at sea?
That is exactly why I have sent for you. I must have an instrument for sighting, to line the ship up with the enemy. It is a question of geometry, and I no longer remember my studies. With his fingerless left hand, the Jew scratched his nose.
Let me think, he said, and left the cabin.
Enders, the unflappable sea artist, had a rare moment of discomposure.
You want what? He said.
I want to set all 32 cannon on the port side, Hunter repeated.
She'll list to port like a pregnant sow, Enders said.
The very idea seemed to offend his sense of propriety and good seamanship. I'm sure she will be ungainly, Hunter said. Can you still sail her?
After a fashion, Enders said. I could sail the Pope's coffin with Milady's dinner napkin.
After a fashion, he sighed.
Of course, he said, you'll shift the cannon once we're in open water.
No, Hunter said. I'll shift them here, in the bay. Enders sighed again.
So you want to clear the reef with your pregnant sow?
Yes.
That means cargo topside, Enders said, staring into space.
We'll move those cases in the hold up on the starboard railing and lash them there. It'll help some, but then we are top-heavy as well as off-trim.
She'll roll like a cork in a swell. Make the devil's own job to fire those guns.
I'm only asking if you can sail her. There was a long silence.
I can sail her, Enders said finally. I can sail her just as pretty as you wish, but you'd better get her back in trim before that storm hits. She won't last 10 minutes in weather.
I know that, Hunter said. The 2 men looked at each other. While they sat, they heard a reverberating rumble overhead as the first of the starboard cannon was shifted to the port side.
You play long odds, Enders said.
They are the only odds I have, Hunter replied. Firing commenced in the early afternoon. A piece of white sailcloth was set 500 yards away, on the shore, and the cannons were fired individually until they struck the target. The positions were marked on the deck with the blade of a knife. It was a long, slow, laborious process, continuing on into the night, when the white sail target was replaced by a small fire. But by midnight, they had all 32 cannon aimed, loaded, and run out. The cargo had been brought topside and lashed to the starboard railing, partially compensating for the list to port. Enders pronounced himself satisfied with the trim of the boat, but his expression was unhappy. Hunter ordered all hands to get a few hours' sleep and announced they would sail with the morning tide. Just before he drifted off to sleep, he wondered what Bosquet would make of the day's cannon fire inside the cove. Would he guess the meaning of those shots? And what would he do if he did? Hunter did not ponder the question. He would know soon enough, he thought, and closed his eyes. Chapter 30. He was on deck at dawn, pacing back and forth, watching the crew's preparations for battle. Lines and braces were being doubled so that if some were shot away, the others would allow the ship to sail. Bedding and blankets, soaked in water, were lashed along rails and bulkheads to protect against flying splinters. The entire deck was washed down repeatedly, soaking the dry wood to reduce the danger of fire. In the midst of all this, Enders came up. "Lookouts just reported, Captain. The warship is gone." Hunter was stunned.
"Gone?"
"Aye, Captain. Gone during the night." "It is not in sight at all?"
"Aye, Captain."
"He cannot have given up," Hunter said. He considered the possibilities a moment. Perhaps the warship had gone to the north or south side of the island to lie in wait. Perhaps Bosque had some other plan, or perhaps the pounding by the Saker had done more damage than the privateers suspected. "All right, carry on," Hunter said. The immediate effect of the warship's disappearance was salutary, he knew. It meant that he would be able to make a safe exit from Monkey Bay with his ungainly ship. That passage had been worrying him. Across the bay, he saw Saint-Saëns directing preparations aboard the Cassandra. The sloop sat lower in the water today. During the night, Hunter had transferred half the treasure from his vaults to the hold of the Cassandra. There was a good likelihood that at least one of the two ships might be sunk, and he wanted at least part of the treasure to survive. Saint-Saëns waved to him. Hunter waved back, thinking that he did not envy Saint-Saëns this coming day. According to their plans, in an attack the smaller ship would run for the nearest safe harbor, while Hunter engaged the Spanish warship. That was not without risk for Saint-Saëns, who might find it difficult to escape unmolested. If the Spaniard chose to attack Saint-Saëns first, Hunter's ship would be unable to attack. El Trinidad's cannons were prepared only for two volleys of defense. But if Saint-Saëns feared this eventuality, he gave no sign. His wave was cheery enough. A few minutes later, the two ships raised anchor and, under light sail, made for the open sea. The sea was rough. Once past the coral reefs and shallow water, there were 40-knot winds and 12-foot swells. In that water, the Cassandra bobbed and bounced, but Hunter's galleon wallowed and slopped like a sick animal. Enders complained bitterly and then asked Hunter to take the helm for a moment. Hunter watched as the sea artist moved forward in the boat until he was standing clear of all the sails in the bow. Enders stood with his back to the wind and both arms stretched wide. He remained there a moment, then turned slightly, still keeping his arms wide. Hunter recognized the old seaman's trick for locating the eye of a hurricane. If you stood with your arms out and your back to the wind, the eye of the storm was always 2 points forward of the left hand's direction. Enders came back to the helm, grunting and swearing. "She's south-southwest," he said, "and damn me if we won't feel her strong before nightfall." Indeed, the sky overhead was already darkening gray, and the wind seemed to strengthen with each passing minute. El Trinidad listed unhappily as she cleared Cat Island and felt the full roughness of the open sea. "Damn me," Enders said. "I don't trust all those cannon, Captain. Can't we shift just two or three to starboard?" "No," Hunter said. "Make her sail smarter," Enders said. "You'd like it, Captain." "So would Bosque," Hunter said.
"Show me Bosque," Enders said, "and you can keep your cannon with nary a word from me."
"He's there," Hunter said, pointing astern. Enders looked and saw the Spanish warship clear the north shore of Cat Island and in hot pursuit of the galleon.
"Right up a bumhole," Enders said. "God's bones, he's well set."
The warship was bearing down on the most vulnerable part of the galleon, its aft deck. Any ship was weak astern. That was why the treasure was always stowed forward, and why the most spacious cabins were always astern. A ship's captain might have a large compartment, but in time of battle it was assumed he would not be in it. Hunter had no guns aft at all. Every piece of bronze hung on the port side. and their ungainly list deprived Enders of the traditional defense from a rear attack, a twisting, erratic course to make a poor target. Enders had to hold his best course to keep the ship from taking on water, and he was unhappy about it. "Steady as you go," Hunter said, "and keep land to starboard." He went forward to the side railing where Don Diego was sighting along an odd instrument he had made. It was a wooden contraption, roughly 3 feet long, mounted to the mainmast. At each end there was a small, square frame of wood with crossed hairs, forming an X.
"It's simple enough," the Jew said. "You sight along here," he said, standing at one end. "And when you have the two sets of hairs matched, you are in the proper position. Whatever part of your target is in the crossing of the hairs is what you will strike."
"What about the range?"
"For that, you need Lazoo."
Hunter nodded. Lazoo, with her sharp eyes, could estimate distances with remarkable accuracy.
"Range is not the problem," the Jew said. "The problem is timing the swells. Here, look."
Hunter stepped into position behind the crosshairs. He closed one eye and squinted until the double X overlapped. And then he saw how much the boat pitched and rocked. One instant the crosshairs were pointing at empty sky. The next, they were pointing into the rolling sea. In his mind, he pretended to fire a round of shot. Between his shouted command and the moment the gunners tugged on the shot cords, there would be a delay, he knew. He had to estimate that, and the shot itself was slow-moving. Another half-second would pass before the target was struck. Altogether, more than a second between the order to fire and the impact. In that second, the ship would roll and bounce madly on the ocean. He felt a wave of panic. His desperate plan was impossible in heavy seas. They would never be able to get off two accurately aimed volleys.
"Where timing is paramount," the Jew suggested, "the example of the duel might be useful."
"Good," Hunter said. It was a helpful thought. "Notify the gun crews. The signals will be ready to fire. 3, 2, 1, fire. Yes?"
"I shall tell them," the Jew said. "But in the noise of battle."
Hunter nodded. The Jew was very acute today, and thinking much more clearly than Hunter himself. Once the firing began, verbal signals would be lost or misunderstood. "I shall call the commands. You stand at my side and give hand signals." The Jew nodded and went to tell the crews. Hunter called for Lazoo and explained to her the need for accurate ranging. The shot was aimed for 500 yards. She would have to measure with delicacy. She said she could do it. He went back to Enders, who was delivering a continuous string of oaths.
"We shall taste his bugger's staff soon enough," he said. "I can feel that prickle upon the flower."
At that moment, the Spanish warship opened fire with its bow cannon. Small shot whistled through the air.
"Hot as an ardent boy," Enders said, shaking his fist in the air.
A second volley splintered wood on the aft castle, but caused no serious damage.
"Steady on," Hunter said.
"Let him gain."
"Let him gain. Tell me how I could do other."
"Keep your wits," Hunter said.
"It's not my wits at risk," Enders said, "but my dearest bunghole."
A third volley passed harmlessly amidships, the small shot whistling through the air. Hunter had been waiting for that.
"Smoke pots," Hunter shouted,
and the crew raced to light the caskets of pitch and sulfur on deck. Smoke billowed into the air and drifted astern. Hunter knew that this would give the appearance of damage. He could well imagine how El Trinidad appeared to the Spaniard, a listing ship in trouble, now belching dark smoke.
"He's moving east," Enders said. "Coming in for the kill."
"Good," Hunter said.
"Good?" Enders repeated, shaking his head. "Dear Judas's ghost, our captain says good."
Hunter watched as the Spanish warship moved to the port side of the galleon. Basque had begun the engagement in classic fashion and was continuing in the same way. He was moving wide of his target, getting himself onto a parallel course just out of cannon range. Once he had lined up his broadside on the galleon, he would begin to close. As soon as he was within range, starting at about 2,000 yards, Bosquet would open fire and would continue to fire as he came closer and closer. That would be the most difficult period for Hunter and his crew. They would have to weather those broadsides until the Spanish ship was within their range. Hunter watched as the enemy vessel pulled directly into a parallel course with El Trinidad, slightly more than a mile to the port. "Steady on," Hunter said, and rested a hand on Enders' shoulder. "You shall have your way with me," Enders grumbled, "and so will the Donish prickler." Hunter went forward to Lazoo. "She is just under 2,000 yards," Lazoo said, squinting at the enemy profile. "How fast does she close?"
"Fast. She's eager."
"All the better for us," Hunter said.
"She is 1,800 yards now," Lazoo said.
"Stand by for shot," Hunter said. Moments later, the first broadside exploded from the warship and fell splashing into the water off the port side. The Jew counted.
1 Madonna, 2 Madonna, 3 Madonna, 4 Madonna.
"Under 1,700, Lazoo said.
The Jew had counted to 75 when the second broadside was fired. Iron shots screamed through the air all around them, but none struck the ship. Immediately, the Jew began to count again.
1 Madonna, 2 Madonna.
"Not as sharp as she could be," Hunter said. "She should have gotten off in 60 seconds.
1,500 yards, Lazoo muttered.
Another minute went by, and then the third broadside was fired. This found its mark with stunning effect. Hunter was suddenly engulfed in a world of utter confusion. Men screaming, splinters whistling through the air, spars and rigging crashing to the deck.
"Damage!" he shouted. "Call damage!"
He peered through the smoke at the enemy ship, still closing on them. He was not even aware of the seamen at his feet, writhing and screaming with pain, clutching his hands to his face, blood spurting between his fingers. The Jew looked down and saw a giant splinter had passed through the seaman's cheek and upward through the roof of his mouth. In the next moment, Lazoo calmly bent over and shot the man in the head with her pistol. Pinkish, cheesy material was flung all over the wooden deck. With an odd detachment, the Jew realized it was the man's brains. He looked back at Hunter, who was staring at the enemy with fixed gaze.
"Damage report!"
Hunter shouted as the next volley from the warship pounded them.
"Forsprit gone! Foresail gone! Number 2 cannon out! Number 6 cannon out! Mizzen top blown! Out below!"
came the cry, as the mizzen-top spars came crashing down to the deck in a rain of heavy wood and rope rigging. Hunter ducked as spars crashed around him. Canvas covered him, and he struggled to his feet. A knife poked through the canvas just inches from his face. He pulled back and saw daylight. Lazoo was cutting him free.
"Almost got my nose," he said. "You'll never miss it," Lazoo said.
Another volley from the Spanish warship whistled overhead.
"They're high!" Enders screamed in insane jubilation. "Blimey, they're high!"
Hunter looked forward, just as a shot smashed into the number 5 gun crew. The bronze cannon was flung into the air. Heavy splinters of wood flew in all directions. One man took a razor-sharp sliver through the neck. He clutched his throat and fell to the ground, writhing in pain. Nearby, another man took a direct hit from a ball. It cut his body in half, his legs falling out from beneath him. The stump of torso screamed and rolled on the deck for a few moments, until shock brought death.
"Damage report!" shouted Hunter.
A man standing beside him was struck in the head by a tackle block. It shattered his skull, and he fell in a pool of red, sticky blood. The foretop spar came down, pinning 2 men to the deck, crushing their legs. They howled and screamed pitifully. Still, the broadside came from the Spaniard. To stand in the midst of this injury and destruction and keep a cool head was almost impossible. And yet that was what Hunter tried to do, as one volley after another slammed home into his vessel. It had been 20 minutes since the warship opened fire. The deck was littered with rigging and spars and wooden splinters. The screams of the wounded blended with the sizzling whine of the cannonballs that snapped through the air. For Hunter, The destruction and chaos around him had long ago merged into a steady background, so constant he no longer paid attention to it. He knew his ship was being slowly and inexorably destroyed, but he remained fixed on the enemy vessel, which moved closer with each passing second. His losses were heavy. 7 men were dead and 12 wounded. 2 cannon emplacements were destroyed. He had lost his foresprit and all her sail, and he had lost his mizzentop and his mainsail rigging on the lee side. He had taken 2 hits below the waterline, and El Trinidad was shipping water fast. Already he sensed she rode lower in the water and moved less smartly. There was a soggy, heavy quality to her forward progress. He could not attempt to repair the damage. His little crew was busy just holding the ship on a manageable course. It was now a question of time before she became impossible to control or sank outright. He squinted through the smoke and haze at the Spanish ship. It was becoming hard to see. Despite the strong wind, the 2 ships were surrounded by acrid smoke. She was closing fast. 700 yards, Lazou said tonelessly. She had been injured already. A jagged shaft of wood had creased her forearm on the 5th volley. She had quickly applied a tourniquet near the shoulder and now continued her sightings, oblivious to the blood that dripped onto the deck at her feet. Another volley screamed at them, rocking the ship with multiple impacts. 600 yards. Ready to fire, Hunter shouted, bending to sight along the crosshairs. He was lined up for a midships hit, but as he watched, the Spanish warship moved forward slightly. He was now lined on the aft castle. So be it, he thought, as he gauged the rocking of El Trinidad through the crosshairs, getting a sense of the timing up and down, seeing clear sky, then nothing but water, then seeing the warship again. Then clear sky as El Trinidad continued her upward roll. He counted to himself over and over, silently mouthing the words. 500 yards, Lazou said. Hunter watched a moment longer. Then he counted. 1, he shouted, as the crosshairs pointed into the sky. Then the ship rocked down, quickly passing the outline of the warship. 2, he called, as the crosshairs pointed into the boiling sea. There was a brief hesitation in the motion. He waited. 3, he called, as the upward motion began again. Fire! The galleon rocked madly, a crazy upward heave as all 30 of her cannon exploded in a volley. Hunter was thrown back against the mainmast with a force that knocked the breath from him. He hardly noticed it. He was watching for the downward movement to see what had happened to the enemy. You hit her, Lazou said. Indeed he had. The impact had knocked the Spanish vessel laterally in the water, swinging the stern outward. The profile of the aft castle was now a ragged line, and the entire mizzenmast was falling in a strange slow motion, sails and all, into the water. But in the same moment, Hunter saw that he had struck too far forward to damage the rudder, and not far enough forward to hit the helmsman at the tiller. The warship was still under control. Reload and run out, he shouted. There was much confusion aboard the Spanish ship. He knew he had bought time. Whether he had bought the 10 minutes he needed to prepare a second volley, he could not be sure. Seamen were everywhere in the aft of the warship, cutting the fallen mizzenmast away, trying to get free. For a moment, it looked like the debris in the water would foul the rudder, but that did not happen. Hunter heard the rumbling beneath his own decks as one after another, his cannon were reloaded and run back to the gun ports. The Spanish warship was closer now, less than 400 yards to port, but she was angled badly and could not get off a broadside. 1 minute passed, then another. The Spanish ship came under control, her mizzen with its sails and rigging drifting away in the wake of the ship. The bow swung into the wind. She was coming about and moving to Hunter's weak starboard side. Damn me, Enders said. I knew he was a clever bastard. The Spanish ship lined up for a starboard broadside and delivered it a moment later. At this closer range, it was miserably effective. Spars and rigging came crashing down around Hunter. We cannot take any more, Lazou said softly. Hunter had been thinking the same thing. How many cannon run out? He shouted. Don Diego below peered up onto the deck.
16 ready.
We will fire with 16, Hunter said. Another broadside from the Spanish warship hit them with devastating effect. Hunter's ship was shattering around him.
Mr. Enders, Hunter bellowed, prepare to come about.
Enders looked at Hunter in disbelief. To come about now would bring Hunter's ship through the bow of the Spanish ship, and much closer.
Prepare to come about, Hunter shouted again. Ready about, Enders yelled.
Astounded seamen ran to the lines, furiously working to unsnarl them. The warship closed.
350 yards, Lazu said.
Hunter hardly heard her. He no longer cared about the range. He sighted down the crosshairs at the smoky profile of the warship. His eyes stung and blurred with tears. He blinked them away and fixed on an imaginary point on the Spanish profile, low and just behind the bow line.
Ready about, the helm's alee,
Enders bellowed.
Ready to fire,
Hunter shouted. Enders was astonished. Hunter knew it without looking at the sea artist's face. He kept his eye to the crosshairs. Hunter was going to fire while the ship was coming about. It was unheard of, an insane thing to do.
One,
Hunter shouted. In the crosshairs, he saw his ship swing through the wind, coming around to bear on the Spaniard.
Two!
His own ship was moving slowly now, the crosshairs inching forward along the warship's hazy profile, past the forward gun ports, onto bare wood.
Three!
The crosshairs crept forward on the target, but it was too high. He waited for a dip in his own ship, knowing that at the same moment the warship would rise slightly, exposing more flank. He waited, not daring to breathe, not daring to hope. The warship rode up a little, then...
Fire!
Again his ship rocked under the impact of the cannon. It was a ragged volley. Hunter heard it and felt it, but he could see nothing. He waited for the smoke to clear and the ship to right herself. He looked.
Mother of God, Lazu said.
There was no change in the Spanish warship. Hunter had missed her clean.
Damn me to hell,
Hunter said, thinking that there was now an odd truth to the words. They were all damned to hell. The next broadside from the Spaniards would finish them off. Don Diego said,
It was a noble try. A noble try and bravely done.
Lazu shook her head. She kissed him on the cheek.
The saints preserve us all, she said.
A tear ran down her cheek. Hunter felt a crushing despair.
They had missed their final chance. He had failed them all.
There was nothing to do now but run up the white flag and surrender.
Mr. Enders, he called. Run up the white...
He stopped cold. Enders was dancing behind the tiller, slapping his thigh, laughing uproariously. Then he heard a cheer from below decks. The gun crews were cheering. Were they mad? Alongside him, Lazu gave a shriek of delight and began to laugh as loudly as Enders. Hunter spun to look at the Spanish warship. He saw the bow lift in a wave, and then he saw the gaping hole running 7 or 8 feet wide open below the waterline. A moment later, the bow plunged down again, obscuring the damage. He hardly had time to recognize the significance of this sight when clouds of smoke billowed out of the forecastle of the warship. They rose with startling suddenness. A moment later, an explosion echoed across the water. And then the warship disappeared in a giant sphere of exploding flame as the powder hold went off. There was one rumbling detonation, so powerful that El Trinidad shook with the impact. Then another, and a third as the warship dissolved before their eyes in a matter of seconds. Hunter saw only the most fragmentary images of destruction, the masts crashing down, the cannon flung into the air by invisible hands, the whole substance of the ship collapsing in on itself, then blasting outward. Something crashed into the mainmast over his head and dropped onto his hair. It slid down to his shoulder and onto the deck. He thought it must be a bird, but looking down, saw that it was a human hand, severed at the wrist. There was a ring on one finger.
"Good God," he whispered.
And when he looked back at the warship, he saw an equally astonishing sight. The warship was gone. Literally gone. 1 minute it had been there, consumed by fire and hot spheres of explosion, and yet there. Now it was gone. Burning debris, sails, and spars floated on the surface of the water. The bodies of seamen floated with them, and he heard the screams and shouts of the survivors. Yet the warship was gone. All around him, his crew was laughing and jumping in frenzied celebration. Hunter could only stare at the water where the warship had once been. Amid the burning wreckage, his eye fell on a body floating face down in the water. The body was that of a Spanish officer. Hunter could tell from the blue uniform on the man's back. The man's trousers had been shredded in the explosions, and his naked buttocks were exposed to view. Hunter stared at the bared flesh, fascinated that the back should be uninjured, and yet the clothing below torn away. There was something obscene about the randomness and casualness of the injury. Then, as the body bounced on the waves, Hunter saw that it was headless. Aboard his own ship, he was distantly aware that the crew was no longer jubilant. They had all fallen silent and had turned to look at him. He looked around at their faces, weary, smudged, bleeding, the eyes drained and blank with fatigue, and yet oddly expectant. They were looking at him and waiting for him to do something. For a moment, he could not imagine what was expected of him. And then he became aware of something on his cheeks. Rain.
Chapter 31. The hurricane struck with furious intensity. Within minutes, the wind was screaming through the rigging at more than 40 knots, lashing them with stinging pellets of rain. The seas were rougher, with 15-foot swells, mountains of water that swung the boat crazily. One moment they were high in the air, riding the crest of a swell. Seconds later they were plunged into a stomach-wrenching trough, with water looming high all around them. And each man knew that this was just the beginning. The wind and the rain and the seas would become much worse, and the storm would last for hours, perhaps days. They sprang to work with an energy that belied the fatigue they all felt. They cleared the decks and reefed shredded canvas. They fought to get a sail over the side and plugged the holes in the ship below the waterline. They worked in silence on the slippery, shifting, wet decks, each man knowing that at the next instant he might be swept overboard and that no one would even see it happen. But the first task, and the worst, was to trim the ship by moving the cannon back to the starboard side. This was no easy matter on calm seas with dry decking. In a storm, when the ship was taking water over her sides, with the deck pitching to 45-degree angles, with every deck surface and line soaked and slippery, it was plainly impossible and a nightmare. Yet it had to be done if they were to survive. Hunter directed the operation, one cannon at a time. It was a problem of anticipating the pitch, of letting the angles do the work as the men wrestled with the 5,000-pound weights. They lost the first cannon. A line snapped, and the gun shot across the slanted deck like a missile, shattering the hull railing on the far side and crashing into the water. The men were terrified by the speed with which it happened. Double lines were lashed around the second cannon, yet it also broke free, crushing a seaman in its path. For the next 5 hours, they battled the wind and the rain to get the cannon in position and safely lashed down. When they were finished, every man on El Trinidad was exhausted beyond endurance. The sailors clung like drowning animals to stays and railings, exerting every last ounce of energy to keep from being washed over the side. And yet, Hunter knew, the storm was just beginning. A hurricane, the most awesome event in nature, was discovered by the voyagers to the New World. The name, hurricane, is an Arawak word for storms that had no counterpart in Europe. Hunter's crew knew of the awful power of these giant cyclonic events,
and responded to the terrible physical reality of the storm with the oldest sailor superstitions and rites. Enders, at the helm, watched the mountains of water all around him and muttered every prayer he had ever learned as a boy, while he simultaneously clutched the shark's tooth around his neck and wished he could raise more canvas. El Trinidad was struggling with three sails at the moment, and it was unlucky to sail with three. Below decks, the Moor took his dagger and cut his own finger, then drew a triangle on the deck with his blood. He placed a feather in the center of the triangle and held it there while he whispered an incantation to himself. Forward, Lazoo threw a casket of salt pork over the side and held three fingers into the air. Hers was the most ancient superstition of all, though she knew only the old seaman's tale that food over the side and three fingers in the air might save a foundering ship. In fact, the three fingers represented the trident of Neptune, and the food was a sacrifice to the god of the oceans. Hunter himself professed to despise such superstition, yet he went to his cabin, locked the door, got down on his knees, and prayed. All around him, the furniture of the cabin crashed back and forth from one wall to another, as the ship rocked crazily on the seas. Outside, the storm screamed with demonic fury, and the ship beneath him creaked and groaned in long, agonizing moans. At first, he did not notice any other sound, and then he heard a woman's scream, and then another. He left his cabin and found five sailors dragging Lady Sarah Almont forward to the companionway ladder. She was screaming and wrestling in their grip. "Hold there!" Hunter shouted and went up to them. Waves crashed over them, smashing against the deck. The men would not look him in the eye. "What goes here?" Hunter demanded. None of the men spoke. It was Lady Sarah who finally shrieked, "They're going to throw me in the ocean!" The leader of the men seemed to be Edwards, a rough seaman, veteran of dozens of privateering campaigns.
"She's a witch," he said, looking at Hunter defiantly. "That's what she is, Captain. We'll never last this storm if she's on board."
"Don't be ridiculous," Hunter said.
"Mark me," Edwards said. "We'll not last with her on board. Mark me, she's a witch as ever I saw."
"How do you know this?"
"I know it first I seen her," Edwards said.
"By what proofs?" Hunter persisted.
"The man is mad," Lady Sarah said. "Stark mad."
"What proofs?" Hunter demanded, shouting over the wind. Edwards hesitated. Finally, he released the girl and turned away.
"No use talking of it," he said. "You mark me, though. Mark me."
He walked away. One by one, the other men backed off. Hunter was alone with Lady Sarah. "Go to your cabin," Hunter said, "and bolt the door and stay there. On no account come out, and do not open the door for any reason." Her eyes were wide with fright. She nodded and went to her room. Hunter waited until he saw the door to her cabin close, and then, after a moment's hesitation, he went on deck into the full blast of the storm. Below decks, the storm seemed fearsome, but on the main deck, it exceeded all preparation. The wind tore at him like an invisible brute, 1,000 strong hands pulling at his arms and legs, wrenching him away from any handhold or support. The rain struck him with such force that at first he cried aloud. He could hardly see in the first few seconds. He made out Enders at the tiller, lashed firmly into his position. Hunter went over to him, holding to a guideline strung along the deck, finally reaching the shelter of the aft castle. He took an extra line and looped it around himself, leaned closer to Enders and shouted,
"How fare you?" "No better, no worse," Enders shouted back. "We hold, and we'll hold some while longer, but it's hours. I can feel her start to break." "How many hours?"
Enders' reply was lost in the mountain of water that surged over them and smashed down on the deck. It was, Hunter thought, as good an answer as any. No ship could take such a pounding for long, especially not a crippled ship. Back in her cabin,
Lady Sarah Almont surveyed the destruction caused by the storm, and the seamen who had burst in upon her as she had been making her preparations. Carefully, as the boat rocked, she righted her candles on the deck and lit them one after another until there were 5 red candles glowing. Then she scratched a pentagram on the deck and stepped inside it. She was very afraid. When the Frenchwoman, Madame de Rochambeau, had shown her the latest in the fads of the court of Louis XIV, she had been amused, even scoffed a little. But they said in France that women killed their newborn babies in order to secure eternal youth. If that was so, perhaps a little, to preserve an Englishwoman's life. What was the harm? She closed her eyes, hearing the storm howl around her. "Greedigut," she whispered, feeling the words on her lips. She caressed herself, kneeling on the deck inside the scratched pentagram. "Greedigut. Greedigut, come to me." The deck pitched crazily. The candles slid one way, then the next. She had to pause to catch them in their slide. It was all very distracting. How difficult to be a witch. Madame de Rochambeau had told her nothing of spells aboard ship. Perhaps they did not work. Perhaps it was all a lot of French foolishness. "Greedigut," she moaned. She caressed herself. And then she fancied she heard the storm abating. Or was it just her imagination? "Greedigut, come to me. Have me. Dwell in me." She imagined claws. She felt the wind whipping at her nightdress. She sensed a presence. And the wind died. Part 4. The Mouth of the Dragon. Chapter 32. Hunter awoke from a restless sleep with an odd sense that something was wrong. He sat up in bed and realized that everything was quieter. The motion of the ship was less frantic, and the wind had died to a whisper. He hurried onto the deck where a light rain was falling. He saw that the seas were calmer and visibility had increased. Enders, still at the tiller, looked half dead, but he was grinning. "We weathered her, Captain," he said. "Not much left to her, but we've come through." Enders pointed to starboard. There was land, the low gray profile of an island. "What is it?" Hunter said. "Dunno," Enders said, "but we'll just make it." Their ship had been blown for 2 days and 2 nights, and they had no idea of their position. They approached the little island, which was low and scrubby and uninviting. Even from a distance, they could see the cactus plants thick along the shore. "I reckon we're down the leeward chain," Enders said, squinting judiciously. "Probably near the Boca del Dragon, and there's no respite in those waters," he sighed. "Wish we could see the sun for a sighting." The Boca del Dragon, the Dragon's Mouth, was the stretch of water between the leeward Caribbean islands and the coast of South America. It was a famous and feared stretch of water, though at the moment it seemed placid enough. Despite calm seas, El Trinidad rolled and wallowed like a drunkard. Yet they managed, with shredded canvas, to round the southern tip of the island and find a fair cove on the western shore. It was protected and had a sandy bottom suitable for careening. Hunter secured the ship, and his exhausted crew went ashore to rest. There was no sign of Sanson or the Cassandra. Whether they had survived the storm was a matter of indifference to Hunter's men, exhausted beyond the point of reasonable fatigue. The men lay sprawled in their wet clothes on the beach and slept with their faces in the sand, their bodies prostrate like corpses. The sun emerged, briefly, from behind thinning clouds. Hunter felt weariness overtake him, and sleep as well. The next 3 days were fair. The crew worked hard careening the ship, repairing the damage below the waterline and the spars of the ragged superstructure. A search of the ship disclosed no wood aboard. Normally, a galleon the size of El Trinidad carried extra spars and masts in the hold, but these had been removed by the Spanish to allow more cargo. Hunter's men had to make do as best they could. Enders sighted the sun with his astrolabe
and fixed their latitude at 40 degrees, very far south. They were not far from the Spanish strongholds of Cartagena and Maracaibo on the South American coast. But aside from this, they had no knowledge of their island, which they called No Name Key. Hunter felt a captain's vulnerability with El Trinidad hauled over on her side, unseaworthy. Should they be attacked now, they would have a difficult time of it. Still, he had no reason to fear anything. The island was obviously uninhabited, as were the two nearest little islands to the south. But there was something hostile and uninviting about No Name. The land was arid and thickly overgrown with cactus, in places as dense as any forest. Brightly colored birds chattered high up in the overgrowth, their cries carried by the wind. The wind never stopped. It was a hot, maddening wind that blew at almost 10 knots throughout the day and night, with only a brief respite at dawn. The men grew accustomed to working and sleeping with the whine of the wind in their ears. Something about this place made Hunter post guards around the ship and the scattered campfires of the crew. He told himself it was the need to reestablish discipline among the men, but in truth, it was some other foreboding. On the fourth evening, at dinner, he gave the night's watches. Anders would take the first, he himself would take the midnight watch, and he would be relieved by Bellows. He sent a man off to notify Anders and Bellows. The men returned an hour later.
"Sorry, Captain," he said. "I can't find Bellows."
"What do you mean you can't find him?"
"He's not to be found, Captain."
Hunter scanned the undergrowth around the shore. "He's off sleeping somewhere," he said. "Find him and bring him to me. It will be the worse for him."
"Aye, Captain," the man said.
But a search of the cove did not yield any trace of Bellows. In the growing darkness, Hunter called off the search and collected his men around the fires. He counted 34, including the Spanish prisoners and Lady Sarah. He ordered them to stay close to the fires and assigned another man to take Bellows' watch. The night passed uneventfully. In the morning, Hunter led a party in search of wood. There was none to be found on No Name, so he set off with 10 armed men toward the island nearest to the south. This island was, at least from a distance, similar to their own, and Hunter had no real expectation of finding wood. But he felt obliged to search. He beached his boat on the eastern shore and set off with his party into the interior, moving through dense clumps of cactus that plucked and tore at his clothes. They reached high ground at mid-morning and from there made two discoveries. First, they could clearly see the next island in the chain to the south. Thin gray trickles of smoke from a half a dozen fires drifted into the air. The island was obviously inhabited. Of more immediate interest, they saw the roofs of a village along the water on the western coast of the island. From where they stood, the buildings had the crude appearance of a Spanish outpost settlement. Hunter led his men cautiously forward to the village. With muskets at the ready, they slipped from one clump of cactus to another. When they were very close, one of Hunter's men discharged his musket prematurely. The sound of the report echoed and was carried by the wind. Hunter swore and watched for the village to panic. But there was no activity, no sign of life. After a short pause, he led his men down into the village. Almost immediately, he could tell the settlement was deserted. The houses were empty. Hunter entered the first, but he found nothing save a Bible, printed in Spanish, and a couple of moth-eaten blankets thrown across rude, broken beds. Tarantulas scampered for cover in the darkness. He went back into the street. His men moved stealthily into one house after another, only to emerge empty-handed, shaking their heads.
"Perhaps they were warned of our coming," a seaman suggested.
Hunter shook his head. "Look at the bay." In the bay were four small dinghies, all moored in shoal water, rocking gently with the lapping waves. Fleeing villagers would certainly have escaped by water. It made no sense to leave any boats behind.
"Look here," said a crewman, standing on the beach.
Hunter went over. He saw 5 long, deep trenches in the sand, the marks of narrow boats, or perhaps canoes of some sort, pulled up from the beach. There were many footprints of naked feet and some reddish stains.
Is it blood?
I don't know. There was a church, as rudely constructed as the other dwellings, at the north end of the town. Hunter and his men entered it. The interior was demolished, and all the walls were covered in blood. Some sort of slaughter had occurred here, but not recently. At least several days passed. The stench of dried blood was sickening.
What's this?
Hunter went over to a seaman, who was staring at a skin on the ground. It was leathery and scaly. Looks like a crocodile.
Aye, but from where?
Not here, Hunter said. There are no crocs here. He picked it up. The animal had once been large, at least 5 feet. Few Caribbean crocs grew so large. Those in the inland swamps of Jamaica were only 3 or 4 feet.
Skinned some time past, Hunter said.
He examined it carefully. There were holes cut around the head, and a string of rawhide passed through, as if it were to be worn on a man's shoulders.
Damn me, look there, Captain.
Hunter looked toward the next island to the south. The smoke fires, previously visible, had now disappeared. It was then that they heard the faint thumping of drums.